Side 11. Unfinished Tales of Numenor and Middle-earth by J.R.R. Tolkien. Continuing with Cirion and Eorl on page 298.
There is no other way to take. After so long a road, shall we be held back from battle by a river mist?
As they drew nearer, they saw that the white mist was driving back the glooms of Dol Guldur, and soon they passed into it, riding slowly at first and warily. But under its canopy, all things were lit with a clear and shadowless light, while to left and right, they were guarded as it were by white walls of secrecy.
The Lady of the Golden Ward is on our side, it seems, said Barondir.
Maybe, said Eorl. But at least I will trust the wisdom of Felleroth.
Note 28. Eorl's Horse. In Appendix A, 2, to The Lord of the Rings, it is told that Eorl's father, Laod, who was a tamer of wild horses, was thrown by Felleroth when he dared to mount him, and so he met his death. Afterwards, Eorl demanded of the horse that he surrender his freedom till his life's end in Wergild for his father. And Felleroth submitted, though he would allow no man but Eorl to mount him. He understood all that men said, and was as long-lived as they, as were his descendants, the Me'aras, who would bear no one but the King of the Mark or his sons until the time of Shadowfax. Felleroth is a word of the Anglo-Saxon poetic vocabulary, though not in fact recorded in the extant poetry. Very valiant, very strong. End of note.
He scents no evil. His heart is high, and his weariness is healed. He strains to be given his head. So be it, for never have I had more need of secrecy and speed.
Then Felleroth sprang forward, and all the host behind followed like a great wind, but in a strange silence, as if their hooves did not beat upon the ground. So they rode on, as fresh and eager as on the morning of their setting out, during that day and the next. But at dawn of the third day, they rose from their rest, and suddenly the mist was gone, and they saw that they were far out in the open lands. On their right, the Anduin lay near, but they had almost passed its great eastward loop, and the Undeeps were in sight. Note 29. Between the inflow of the Limlight and the Undeeps, author's note. This seems certainly in contradiction to the first citation given in Appendix C to the History of Galadriel and Celeborn, page 260, where the North and South Undeeps are the two westward bends of the Anduin into the northmost of which the Limlight flowed in. End of note. It was the morning of the 15th day of Veressa, and they had come there at a speed beyond hope. Note 30. In 9 days they had covered more than 500 miles in a direct line, probably more than 600 as they rode. Though there were no great natural obstacles on the east side of Anduin, much of the land was now desolate, and roads or horse paths running southward were lost or little used. Only for short periods were they able to ride at speed, and they needed also to husband their own strength and their horses, since they expected battle as soon as they reached the Undeeps. Author's note. End of note. Editor. Here the text ends, with a note that a description of the Battle of the Field of Celebrant was to follow. In Appendix A, 2 to The Lord of the Rings, there is a summary account of the war. Author. A great host of wild men from the northeast swept over Rovanion, and coming down out of the Brownlands, crossed the Anduin on rafts. At the same time, by chance or design, the orcs, who at that time before their war with the dwarves were in great strength, made a descent from the mountains. The invaders overran Calenarthon, and Cirion, steward of Gondor, sent north for help. Editor. When Eorl and his riders came to the field of Celebrant. Author. The northern army of Gondor was in peril. Defeated in the Wold and cut off from the south, it had been driven across the Limlight, and was then suddenly assailed by the orc host that pressed it towards the Anduin. All hope was lost when, unlooked for, the riders came out of the north and broke upon the rear of the enemy. Then the fortunes of battle were reversed, and the enemy was driven with slaughter over Limlight. Eorl led his men in pursuit, and so great was the fear that went before the horsemen of the north that the invaders of the Wold were also thrown into panic, and the riders hunted them over the plains of Calenarthon. Editor. A similar briefer account is given elsewhere in Appendix A, 1-4,
From neither is the course of the battle perhaps perfectly clear, but it seems certain that the riders, having passed over the Undeeps, then crossed the Limelight, see note 27, page 313, and fell upon the rear of the enemy at the field of Celebrant. And that the enemy was driven with slaughter over Limelight means that the Balchoth were driven back southwards into the Wald. 3. Cirion and Eorl. The story is preceded by a note on the Halaferian, westernmost of the beacons of Gondor along the line of Ered Nimrais. Author: The Halaferian was the highest of the beacons, and like Eilenach, the next in height, appeared to stand up alone out of a great wood, for behind it there was a deep cleft, the dark Firiondale, in the long northward spur of Ered Nimrais, of which it was the highest point. Note 31. The Halaferian is twice mentioned in The Lord of the Rings. In The Return of the King, 1-1, when Pippin, riding with Gandalf on Shadowfax to Minas Tirith, cried out that he saw fires, Gandalf replied, "The beacons of Gondor are alight, calling for aid. War is kindled. See, there is fire on Amundin and flame on Ailenach, and there they go speeding west. Nardol, Arilas, Min Rimon, Calenhad, and the Halaferian on the borders of Rohan." In 1-3, the riders of Rohan on their way to Minas Tirith passed through the Fenmarch, where to their right, great oak woods climbed on the skirts of the hills under the shades of dark Halaferian by the borders of Gondor. See the large-scale map of Gondor and Rohan in The Lord of the Rings. End of note. Out of the cleft it rose like a sheer wall, but its outer slopes, especially northwards, were long and nowhere steep, and trees grew upon them almost to its summit. As they descended, the trees became ever more dense, especially along the Meering stream, which rose in the cleft, and northwards out into the plain through which the stream flowed into the Entwash. The great west road passed through a long cutting in the wood to avoid the wet land beyond its northern eaves. But this road had been made in ancient days, and after the departure of Isildur, no tree was ever felled in the Firion Wood, except only by the beacon wardens, whose task it was to keep open the great road and the path towards the summit of the hill. Note 32. It was the great Numenorian road linking the two kingdoms, crossing the Isen at the fords of Isen, and the Grey Flood at Tharbad, and then on northwards to Fornost, elsewhere called the North-South Road. See page 264. End of note. This path turned from the road near to its entrance into the wood and wound its way up to the end of the trees, beyond which there was an ancient stairway of stone leading to the beacon site, a wide circle leveled by those who had made the stair. The beacon wardens were the only inhabitants of the wood, save wild beasts. They housed in lodges in the trees near the summit, but they did not stay long, unless held there by foul weather, and they came and went in turns of duty. For the most part they were glad to return home, not because of the peril of the wild beasts, nor did any evil shadow out of dark days lie upon the wood, but beneath the sounds of the winds, the cries of birds and beasts, or at times the noise of horsemen riding in haste upon the road, there lay a silence, and a man would find himself speaking to his comrades in a whisper, as if he expected to hear the echo of a great voice that called from far away and long ago. The name Halaferian meant in the language of the Rohirrim, Holy Mountain. Note 33. This is a modernized spelling for Anglo-Saxon, Hallig Firgin. Similarly, Firiondale for Firgindale, Firion Wood for Firginwudu. Author's note. The G in the Anglo-Saxon word Firgin, mountain, came to be pronounced as a modern Y. End of note. Before their coming, it was known in Sindarin as Amun Anwar, Hill of All, for what reason was not known in Gondor, except only, as later appeared, to the ruling king or steward. For the few men who ever ventured to leave the road and wander under the trees, the wood itself seemed reason enough. In the common speech, it was called the Whispering Wood. In the great days of Gondor, no beacon was built on the hill while the Palantiri still maintained communication between Osgiliath and the three towers of the realm without need of messages or signals. Note 34. Minus Ithil, minus Anor, and Orthanc. End of note. In later days, little aid could be expected from the north, as the people of Kalanarthon declined. Nor was armed force sent thither as Minas Tirith became more and more hard put to it to hold the line of the Anduin and guard its southern coast. In Anorion, many people still dwelt, and had the task of guarding the northern approaches, either out of Kalanarthon or across the Anduin at Cair Andros. For communication with them, the three oldest beacons, Amundin, Ailinach, and Min Rimmon, were built and maintained. But though the line of the Mering stream was fortified, between the impassable marshes of its confluence with the Entwash and the bridge where the road passed westward out of the Firion Wood, it was not permitted that any fort or beacon should be set upon Amun Anwar. Note 35. It is said elsewhere, in a note on the names of the beacons, that the full beacon system that was still operating in the War of the Ring can have been no older than the settlement of the Rohirrim in Kalanarthon some 500 years before, for its principal function was to warn the Rohirrim that Gondor was in danger, or, more rarely, the reverse. End of note. In the days of Cirion the Steward, there came a great assault by the Balhoth, who, allied with orcs, crossed the Anduin into the Wold and began the conquest of Kalanarthon. From this deadly peril which would have brought ruin upon Gondor, the coming of Eorl the Young and the Rohirrim rescued the realm. When the war was over, men wondered in what way the Steward would honor Eorl and reward him, and expected that a great feast would be held in Minas Tirith at which this would be revealed. But Cirion was a man who kept his own counsel. As the diminished army of Gondor made its way south, he was accompanied by Eorl and an Eored of the Riders of the North. Note 36. According to a note on the ordering of the Rohirrim, the Eored had no precisely fixed number, but in Rohan it was only applied to riders fully trained for war, men serving for a term or in some cases permanently in the king's host. Any considerable body of such men, riding as a unit, in exercise, or on service, was called an Eored. But after the recovery of the Rohirrim and the reorganization of their forces in the days of King Fulquine, 100 years before the War of the Ring, a full Eored in battle order was reckoned to contain not less than 120 men, including the captain, and to be 100th part of the full muster of the Riders of the Mark, not including those of the king's household. The Eored, with which Éomer pursued the orcs, the two towers, 3-2, had 120 riders. Legolas counted 105 when they were far away, and Éomer said that 15 men had been lost in battle with the orcs. No such host, of course, had ever ridden altogether to war beyond the mark. But Théoden's claim that he might, in this great peril, have led out an expedition of 10,000 riders, the return of the king, 5-3, was no doubt justified. The Rohirrim had increased since the days of Fulquine, and before the attacks of Saruman, a full muster would probably have produced many more than 12,000 riders, so that Rohan would not have been denuded entirely of trained defenders. In the event, owing to losses in the Western War, the hastiness of the muster, and the threat from north and east, Théoden only let out a host of some 6,000 spears, though this was still the greatest riding of the Rohirrim that was recorded since the coming of Eorl. The full muster of the cavalry was called Eohere. See note 49. These words, and also Eotheod, are of course Anglo-Saxon in form, since the true language of Rohan is everywhere thus translated. See note 6 above. They contain as their first element Eo, horse. Eored, Eorod, is a recorded Anglo-Saxon word, its second element derived from rod, riding. In Eohere, the second element is here, host, army. Eotheod has theod, people, or land, and is used both of the riders themselves and of their country. Anglo-Saxon Eorl, in the name Eorl the Young, is a wholly unrelated word. End of note. When they came to the Mering Stream, Cirion turned to Eorl and said, to men's wonder, "Farewell now, Eorl, son of Leod. I will return to my home, where much needs to be set in order. Kalanarthon, I commit to your care for this time, if you are not in haste to return to your own realm. In 3 months' time I will meet you here again, and then we will take counsel together." "I will come," Eorl answered, and so they parted. As soon as Kirion came to Minas Tirith, he summoned some of his most trusted servants.
"Go now to the Whispering Wood," he said. "There you must reopen the ancient path to Amun Anwar. It is long overgrown, but the entrance is still marked by a standing stone beside the road, at that point where the northern region of the wood closes in upon it. The path turns this way and that, but at each turn there is a standing stone. Following these you will come at length to the end of the trees and find a stone stair that leads on upwards. I charge you to go no further. Do this work as swiftly as you may, and then return to me. Fell no trees. Only clear a way by which a few men on foot can easily pass upwards. Leave the entrance by the road still shrouded, so that none that use the road may be tempted to use the path before I come there myself. Tell no one whither you go or what you have done. If any ask, say only that the Lord Steward wishes for a place to be made ready for his meeting with the Lord of the Riders." In due time, Kirion set out with Hollis, his son, and the Lord of Dol Amroth, and two others of his council, and he met Errol at the crossing of the Mering Stream. With Errol were three of his chief captains. "Let us go now to the place that I have prepared," said Kirion.
Then they left a guard of riders at the bridge and turned back into the tree-shadowed road and came to the standing stone. There they left their horses and another strong guard of soldiers of Gondor. And Kirion, standing by the stone, turned to his companions and said,
"I go now to the Hill of Awe. Follow me if you will. With me shall come an esquire, and another with Errol to bear our arms. All others shall go unarmed as witnesses of our words and deeds in the high place. The path has been made ready, though none have used it since I came here with my father."
Then Kirion led Errol into the trees, and the others followed in order. And after they had passed the first of the inner stones, their voices were stilled, and they walked warily, as if unwilling to make any sound. So they came at last to the upper slopes of the hill, and passed through a belt of white birches, and saw the stone stair going up to the summit. After the shadow of the wood, the sun seemed hot and bright, for it was the month of Urime. Yet the crown of the hill was green, as if the year were still in Lotese. At the foot of the stair there was a small shelf or cove made in the hillside with low turf banks. There the company sat for a while, until Kirion rose, and from his esquire took the white wand of office and the white mantle of the stewards of Gondor. Then, standing on the first step of the stair, he broke the silence, saying in a low but clear voice,
"I will now declare what I have resolved, with the authority of the stewards of the kings, to offer to Errol, son of Leod, lord of the Eotheod, in recognition of the valor of his people and of the help beyond hope that he brought to Gondor in time of dire need. To Eorl I will give in free gift all the great land of Cullenarthon, from Anduin to Isen. There, if he will, he shall be king, and his heirs after him, and his people shall dwell in freedom while the authority of the stewards endures until the great king returns."
Note 37.
This was always said in the days of the stewards in any solemn pronouncement, though by the time of Kirion, the 12th ruling steward, it had become a formula that few believed would ever come to pass. Author's note. End of note.
"No bond shall be laid upon them other than their own laws and will, save in this only. They shall live in perpetual friendship with Gondor, and its enemies shall be their enemies while both realms endure. But the same bond shall be laid also on the people of Gondor."
Then Errol stood up, but remained for some time silent, for he was amazed by the great generosity of the gift and the noble terms in which it had been offered, and he saw the wisdom of Kirion both on his own behalf as ruler of Gondor, seeking to protect what remained of his realm, and as a friend of the Eotheod, of whose needs he was aware. For they were now grown to a people too numerous for their land in the north, and longed to return south to their former home. But they were restrained by the fear of Dol Guldur. But in Cullenarthon they would have room beyond hope, and yet be far from the shadows of Mirkwood. Yet beyond wisdom and policy, both Kirion and Eorl were moved at that time by the great friendship that bound their peoples together, and by the love that was between them as true men. On the part of Kirion, the love was that of a wise father, old in the cares of the world, for a son in the strength and hope of his youth. While in Kirion, Errol saw the highest and noblest man of the world that he knew, and the wisest, on whom sat the majesty of the kings of men of long ago. At last, when Errol had swiftly passed all these things through his thought, he spoke, saying, Lord Steward of the Great King, the gift that you offer I accept for myself and for my people. It far exceeds any reward that our deeds could have earned, if they had not themselves been a free gift of friendship. But now I will seal that friendship with an oath that shall not be forgotten. Then let us go now to the high place, said Kirion, and before these witnesses take such oaths as seem fitting. Then Kirion went up the stair with Errol, and the others followed, and when they came to the summit, they saw there a wide, oval place of level turf, unfenced. But at its eastern end there stood a low mound on which grew the white flowers of Alfurin, and the westering sun touched them with gold. Note 38. Alfurin, the Cymbelmine of the King's Mounds below Edoras, and the Uilos that Tuor saw in the great ravine of Gondolin in the elder days. See page 55, note 27. Alfurin is named, but apparently of a different flower, in a verse that Legolas sang in Minas Tirith, The Return of the King, 5-9. The golden bells are shaken of Malos and Alfurin in the green fields of Lebanon. End of note. Then the Lord of Dol Amroth, chief of those in the company of Kirion, went towards the mound and saw, lying on the grass before it, and yet unmarred by weed or weather, a black stone. And on the stone, three letters were engraved. Then he said to Kirion, Is this then a tomb? But what great man of old lies here? Have you not read the letters? Said Kirion. I have, said the prince. And therefore I wonder, for the letters are Lambe, Ando, Lambe. But there is no tomb for Elendil, nor has any man since his day dared to use that name. Note 39. The Lord of Dol Amroth had this title. It was given to his ancestors by Elendil, with whom they had kinship. They were a family of the faithful who had sailed from Numenor before the downfall and had settled in the land of Belphalas, between the mouths of Ringlo and Gilrine, with a stronghold upon the high promontory of Dol Amroth, named after the last king of Lorien. Author's note. Elsewhere it is said, page 248, that according to the tradition of their house, the first lord of Dol Amroth was Galador, circa 3rd age, 2004 to 2129, the son of Imrazor, the Numenorian, who dwelt in Balphalas, and the elven lady, Mithrelas, one of the companions of Nimrodel. The note just cited seems to suggest that this family of the faithful settled in Belphalas with a stronghold on Dol Amroth before the downfall of Numenor. And if that is so, the two statements can only be reconciled on the supposition that the line of the princes, and indeed the place of their dwelling, went back more than 2,000 years before Galador's day, and that Galador was called the first lord of Dol Amroth because it was not until his time, after the drowning of Amroth in the year 1981, that Dol Amroth was so named. A further difficulty is the presence of an Adrahil of Dol Amroth, clearly an ancestor of Adrahil, the father of Imrahil, lord of Dol Amroth at the time of the War of the Ring, as a commander of the forces of Gondor in the battle against the Wine Riders in the year 1944. Pages 293 and 294. But it may be supposed that this earlier Adrahil was not called of Dol Amroth at that time. While not impossible, these explanations to save consistency seem to me to be less likely that than of two distinct and independent traditions of the origins of the lords of Dol Amroth. End of note. Note 40. The letters were T-M-T-L-N-D. L. Elendil's name, without vowel marks, which he used as a badge and a device upon his seals. Author's note. End of note. Nonetheless, this is his tomb, said Kirion, and from it comes the awe that dwells on this hill and in the woods below, from Isildur who raised it to Meneldil who succeeded him, and so down all the line of the kings, and down the line of the stewards, even to myself. This tomb has been kept a secret by Isildur's command. For he said, Here is the midpoint of the kingdom of the south, and here shall the memorial of Elendil the Faithful abide in the keeping of the Valar while the kingdom endures. Note
41.
Amin Anwar was in fact the high place nearest to the center of a line from the inflow of the Limelight down to the southern cape of Tall Phallus, and the distance from it to the fords of Isin was equal to its distance from Minas Tirith. Author's note. End of note.
This hill shall be a hallow, and let no man disturb its peace and silence, unless he be an heir of Elendil. I have brought you here, so that the oaths here taken may seem of deepest solemnity to ourselves and to our heirs upon either side.
Then all those present stood a while in silence with bowed heads, until Kirion said to Eorl,
If you are ready, take now your oath, in such manner as seems to you fitting, according to the customs of your people.
Eorl then stood forth, and taking his spear from his esquire, he set it upright in the ground. Then he drew his sword, and cast it up shining in the sun, and catching it again he stepped forward, and laid the blade upon the mound, but with his hand still about the hilts. He spoke then in a great voice, the oath of Eorl. This he said in the tongue of the Eotheod, which in the common speech is interpreted.
Hear now, all peoples who bow not to the shadow in the east. By the gift of the Lord of the Mundberg we will come to dwell in the land that he names Cullenarthon, and therefore I vow in my own name, and on behalf of the Eotheod of the north, that between us and the great people of the west there shall be friendship forever. Their enemies shall be our enemies, their need shall be our need, and whatsoever evil or threat or assault may come upon them, we will aid them to the utmost end of our strength. This vow shall descend to my heirs, all such as may come after me in our new land, and let them keep it in faith unbroken, lest the shadow fall upon them, and they become accursed.
Note 42. Though imperfectly, for it was in ancient terms and made in the forms of verse and high speech that were used by the Rohirrim, in which Eorl had great skill. Author's note. There seems not to be any other version of the oath of Eorl extant apart from that in the common speech given in the text. End of note. Then Eorl sheathed his sword and bowed and went back to his captains. Kirion then made answer. Standing to his full height, he laid his hand upon the tomb, and in his right hand held up the white wand of the stewards, and spoke words that filled those who heard them with awe. For as he stood up, the sun went down in flame in the west, and his white robe seemed to be on fire. And after he had vowed that Gondor should be bound by a like bond of friendship and aid in all need, he lifted up his voice and said in Quenya,
Vanda Sina Temaruva, Elena Noreo Alcar, and Yalian Ar Elendil, Varando Varanwe, Naitiru Vantes Iharar Mahalmasan Minuman, Ari Eru I Or Ilie, Mahalmar Ea Tenoyo.
Note 43. Vanda, an oath, pledge, solemn promise. Ter Maruva, ter, through, mar, abide, be settled or fixed, future tense. Elena Noreo, genitive case, dependent on Alcar, of Elena Nore, the land named starwards. Alcar, glory. Enyalian, en, again, yal, summon, in infinitive, or gerundial form, enyalie, here in dative for the recalling, but governing a direct object, alcar, thus to recall or commemorate the glory. Varando, genitive of varanda, steadfast in allegiance, in keeping oath or promise, faithful. Adjectives used as a title or frequently used attribute of a name are placed after the name, and, as is usual in Quenya, in the case of two declinable names in apposition, only the last is declined. Another reading gives the adjective as vorimo, genitive of vorima, with the same meaning as varanda, varanwe, steadfastness, loyalty, faithfulness, the object of Enyalian. Nai, be it that, may it be that. Nai tiruvantes, be it that they will guard it, that is, may they guard it. NTE, inflection of three plural where no subject is previously mentioned. Iharar, They who are sitting upon, Mahalmasan, locative plural of Mahalma, throne, me, Inna, Numen, west, Ieru-i, the one who, Ea, is, Tenoyo, Tena, up to, as far as, Oyo, an endless period, Tenoyo, forever. Author's notes. End of note. And again he said the common speech. This oath shall stand in memory of the glory of the land of the star, and of the faith of Elendil the Faithful, in the keeping of those who sit upon the thrones of the West, and of the one who is above all thrones forever. Such an oath had not been heard in Middle-earth since Elendil himself had sworn alliance with Gil-galad, king of the Eldar. Note 44. And was not used again until King Elisar returned and renewed the bond in that same place with the king of the Rohirrim, Éomer the 18th, descended from Eorl. It had been held lawful only for the king of Numenor to call Eru to witness, and then only on the most grave and solemn occasions. The line of the kings had come to an end in Ar-Pharazôn, who perished in the downfall. But Elendil Varanda was descended from Tar-Elendil, the fourth king, and was held to be the rightful lord of the faithful, who had taken no part in the rebellion of the kings and had been preserved from destruction. Cirion was the steward of the kings descended from Elendil, and so far as Gondor was concerned, had as regent all their powers until the king should come again. Nonetheless, his oath astounded those who heard it, and filled them with awe, and was alone, over and above the venerable tomb, sufficient to hallow the place where it was spoken. Author's note. Elendil's name, Varanda, the faithful, which appears also in Cirion's oath, was in this note first written Varanwë, which in the oath is a noun, meaning faithfulness, steadfastness. But in Appendix A, 1-2, to The Lord of the Rings, Mardil, the first ruling steward of Gondor, is called Mardil Varanwë, the steadfast. And in the First Age, the elf of Gondolin, who guided Tuar from Vinyamar, was named Varanwë, which in the Index to the Silmarillion I likewise translated the steadfast. End of note. When all was done, and the shadows of evening were falling, Cirion and Eorl with their company went down again in silence through the darkling wood, and came back to the camp by the Meering stream, where tents had been prepared for them. After they had eaten, Cirion and Eorl, with the prince of Dol Amroth, and Eomund, the chief captain of the host of the Eotheod, sat together and defined the boundaries of the authority of the king of the Eotheod and the steward of Gondor. The bounds of the realm of Eorl were to be: in the west, the river Angren, from its junction with the Adorn, and thence northwards to the outer fences of Angrenost, and thence westwards and northwards along the eaves of Fangorn Forest to the river Limlight. And that river was its northern boundary, for the land beyond had never been claimed by Gondor. Note 45. See the first citation in Appendix C to The History of Galadriel and Celeborn, page 260. End of note. In the east, its bounds were the Anduin and the west cliff of the Emmenmuel, down to the marshes of the mouths of Onodlo, and beyond that river the stream of the Glanhir that flowed through the wood of Anwar to join the Onodlo. And in the south, its bounds were the arid Nimrice, as far as the end of their northward arm. But all those vales and inlets that opened northwards were to belong to the Eotheod, as well as the land south of the Hithaglir that lay between the rivers Angren and Adorn. Note 46. These names are given in Sindarin according to the usage of Gondor, but many of them were named anew by the Eotheod, being alterations of the older names to fit their own tongue, or translations of them, or names of their own making. In the narrative of The Lord of the Rings, the names in the language of the Rohirrim are mostly used. Thus, Angren equals Isen, Angrenost equals Isengard, Fangorn, which is also used, equals Entwood, Onodlo equals Entwash, Glanhir equals Meering Stream. Both mean boundary stream. Author's note. The name of the river Limlight is perplexed. There are two versions of the text and note at this point, from one of which it seems that the Sindarin name was Limlich, adapted in the language of Rohan as Limlit, modernized as Limlight. In the other, later version, Limlich is amended, puzzlingly, to Limlit in the text, so that this becomes the Sindarin form. Elsewhere, page 281, the Sindarin name of this river is given as Limlith. In view of this uncertainty, I have given Limlight in the text. Whatever the original Sindarin name may have been, it is at least clear that the Rohan form was an alteration of it, and not a translation, and that its meaning was not known, although in a note written much earlier than any of the foregoing, the name Limlight is said to be a partial translation of Elvish Limlint, Swift Light. The Sindarin names of the Entwash and the Mering Stream are only found here. With Anadla, compare Anadrim. Enid, the Ents. The Lord of the Rings, Appendix F, of Other Races. End of note. In all these regions, Gondor still retained under its own command only the fortress of Angrenost, within which was the third tower of Gondor, the impregnable Orthonk, where was held the fourth of the Palantiri of the southern realm. In the days of Cirion, Angrenost was still manned by a guard of Gondorians, but these had become a small, settled people, ruled by an hereditary captain, and the keys of Orthonk were in the keeping of the steward of Gondor. The outer fences, named in the description of the bounds of the realm of Eorl, were a wall and dike running some 2 miles south of the gates of Angrenost, between the hills in which the Misty Mountains ended. Beyond them were the tilled lands of the people of the fortress. It was agreed also that the great road which had formerly run through Anorion and Cullenarthon to Othrad Ungren, the fords of Isen, and thence northwards on its way to Arnor, should be open to all travelers of either people without hindrance in time of peace, and its maintenance should from the Mering Stream to the fords of Isen be in the care of the Eotheod. Note 47. Othrad Ungren, see page 264, where the Sindarin name for the fords of Isen is given as Ethride Engren. It seems then that both singular and plural forms of the name of the ford, fords, existed. End of note. By this pact, only a small part of the wood of Anwar, west of the Mering Stream, was included in the realm of Eorl. But Cirion declared that the hill of Anwar was now a hallowed place of both peoples, and the Eorlings and the stewards should henceforward share its guard and maintenance. In later days, however, as the Rohirrim grew in power and numbers, while Gondor declined and was ever threatened from the east and by sea, the wardens of Anwar were provided entirely by the people of Eastfold, and the wood became by custom part of the royal domain of the kings of the Mark. The hill they named the Halafirion, and the wood the Firionholt. Note 48. Elsewhere, the wood is always called the Firion Wood, a shortening from Halafirion Wood. Firionholt, a word recorded in Anglo-Saxon poetry, Firgenholt, means the same, mountain wood. See note 33. End of note. In later times, the day of the oath-taking was reckoned as the first day of the new kingdom, when Eorl took the title of King of the Mark of the Riders. But in the event, it was some while before the Rohirrim took possession of the land, and during his life, Eorl was known as Lord of the Eotheod and King of Cullenarthon. The term Mark signified a borderland, especially one serving as a defense of the inner lands of a realm. The Sindarin names Rohan for the Mark and Rohirrim for the people were devised first by Halas, son and successor of Cirion, but were often used not only in Gondor, but by the Eotheod themselves. Note 49. Their proper form was Rohand and Rohirrim, and they were spelt as Rohand or Rohan, and Rohirrim in the records of Gondor. They contain Sindarin Roch, horse, translating the Ea in Eotheod, and in many personal names of the Rohirrim. See note 36. In Rohand, the Sindarin ending nd, and, end, end, ond, was added. It was commonly used in the names of regions or countries, but the D was usually dropped in speech, especially in long names, such as Calenarthon, Ithilien, Lamedon, etc. Rohirrim was modeled on Eohere, the term used by the Eotheod for the full muster of their cavalry in time of war. It was made from Roch, plus Sindarin Hir, Lord, Master, entirely unconnected with the Anglo-Saxon word Here. In the names of peoples, Sindarin Rim, great number, host, Quenya, Rimbe, was commonly used to form collective plurals, as in Eledrim, Edelrim, all elves, Onodrim, the Entfolk, Nogothrim, all dwarves, the dwarf people. The language of the Rohirrim contained the sound here represented by ch, a backspirant as ch in Welsh, and though it was infrequent in the middle of words between vowels, it presented them with no difficulty. But the common speech did not possess it, and in pronouncing Sindarin, in which it was very frequent, the people of Gondor, and less learned, represented it by h in the middle of words, and by k at the end of them, where it was most forcibly pronounced in correct Sindarin. Thus arose the names Rohan and Rohirrim, as used in The Lord of the Rings. Author's note. End of note. The day after the oath-taking, Kirion and Eorl embraced and took their leave unwillingly, for Eorl said, "Lord Steward, I have much to do in haste. This land is now rid of enemies, but they are not destroyed at the root, and beyond Anduin, and under the eaves of Mirkwood, we know not yet what peril lurks. I sent yestereve 3 messengers north, riders brave and skilled, in the hope that one at least will reach my home before me. For I must now return myself, and with some strength. My land was left with few men, those too young and those too old. And if they are to make so great a journey, our women and children, with such goods as we cannot spare, must be guarded, and only the Lord of the Eotheld himself will they follow. I will leave behind me all the strength that I can spare, well nigh half of the host that is now in Calenarthon. Some companies of horsed archers there shall be, to go where need calls, if any bands of the enemy still lurk in the land. But the main force shall remain in the northeast, to guard above all the place where the Balkhoth made a crossing of the Anduin out of the Brownlands. For there is still the greatest danger, and there also is my chief hope, if I return, of leading my people into their new land with as little grief and loss as may be. If I return, I say. But be assured that I shall return, for the keeping of my oath, unless disaster befall us, and I perish with my people on the long road. For that must be on the east side of Anduin, ever under the threat of Mirkwood, and at last must pass through the vale that is haunted by the shadow of the hill that you name Dol Guldur. On the west side there is no road for horsemen, nor for a great host of people and wines, even were not the mountains infested by orcs, and none can pass, few or many, through the Dwemordene, where dwells the white lady and weaves nets that no mortal can pass. Note 50. Eorl appears to have been unconvinced by the token of the white lady's goodwill. See page 299. End of note. By the east road will I come, as I came to Celebrant, and may those whom we called in witness of our oaths have us in their keeping. Let us part now in hope. Have I your leave? Indeed you have my leave, said Kirion, since I see now that it cannot be otherwise. I perceive that in our peril I have given too little thought to the dangers that you have faced, and the wonder of your coming beyond hope over the long leagues from the north. The reward that I offered in joy and fullness of heart at our deliverance now seems little. But I believe that the words of my oath, which I had not forethought ere I spoke them, were not put into my mouth in vain. We will part, then, in hope. After the manner of the Chronicles, no doubt much of what is here put into the mouths of Eorl and Kirion at their parting was said and considered in the debate of the night before. But it is certain that Kirion said at parting his words concerning the inspiration of his oath, for he was a man of little pride and of great courage and generosity of heart, the noblest of the stewards of Gondor. 4. The Tradition of Isildur. It is said that when Isildur returned from the War of the Last Alliance, he remained for a time in Gondor, ordering the realm and instructing Meneldil, his nephew, before he himself departed to take up the kingship of Arnor, With Meneldil and a company of trusted friends, he made a journey about the borders of all the lands to which Gondor laid claim. And as they were returning from the northern bound to Anorion, they came to the high hill that was then called Elenir, but was afterwards called Amon Anwar, Hill of All. Note 51. Elenir was a name of pre-Numenorean origin, evidently related to Elenach. Author's note. According to a note on the beacons, Elenach was probably an alien name, not Sindarin, Numenorean, or common speech. Both Elenach and Elenir were notable features. Elenach was the highest point of the Druadon forest. It could be seen far to the west, and its function in the days of the beacons was to transmit the warning of Amon Din. But it was not suitable for a large beacon fire, there being little space on its sharp summit. Hence the name Nardal, Fire Hilltop, of the next beacon westward. It was on the end of a high ridge, originally part of the Druadon forest, but long deprived of trees by masons and quarriers who came up the Stonewine Valley. Nardal was manned by a guard who also protected the quarries. It was well stored with fuel, and at need a great blaze could be lit, visible on a clear night, even as far as the last beacon, Halifirion, some 120 miles to the westward. In the same note, it is stated that Amon Din, the Silent Hill, was perhaps the oldest, with the original function of a fortified outpost of Minas Tirith, from which its beacon could be seen, to keep watch over the passage into northern Ithilien from Dagorlad, and any attempt by enemies to cross the Anduin at or near Cair Andros. Why it was given this name is not recorded, probably because it was distinctive, a rocky and barren hill standing out and isolated from the heavily wooded hills of the Druadon forest. Tawar in Druedain, little visited by men, beasts, or birds. End of note. That was near to the center of the lands of Gondor. They made a path through the dense woods of its northward slopes, and so came to its summit, which was green and treeless. There they made a level space, and at its eastward end they raised a mound. Within the mound Isildur laid a casket that he bore with him. Then he said, "This is a tomb, and memorial of Elendil the Faithful. Here it shall stand at the midpoint of the Kingdom of the South in the keeping of the Valar, while the kingdom endures. And this place shall be a hallow that none shall profane. Let no man disturb its silence and peace, unless he be an heir of Elendil." They made a stone stair from the fringe of the woods up to the crown of the hill, and Isildur said, "Up this stair let no man climb save the king, and those that he brings with him, if he bids them follow him." Then all those present were sworn to secrecy, but Isildur gave this counsel to Meneldil, that the king should visit the hallow from time to time, and especially when he felt the need of wisdom in days of danger or distress, and thither also he should bring his heir when he was full grown to manhood, and tell him of the making of the hallow, and reveal to him the secrets of the realm and other matters that he should know. Meneldil followed Isildur's counsel, and all the kings that came after him, until Romendakil the First, the fifth after Meneldil. In his time, Gondor was first assailed by Easterlings, and lest the tradition should be broken because of war or sudden death or other misfortune, he caused the tradition of Isildur to be set down in a sealed scroll, together with other things that a new king should know, and this scroll was delivered by the steward to the king before his crowning. Note 52. According to Appendix A, 1-4, to the Lord of the Rings, it was in the days of Ostaher, the fourth king after Meneldil, that Gondor was first attacked by wild men out of the east. But Tarostar, his son, defeated them and drove them out and took the name Romendakil, East Victor. End of note. Note 53. It was also Romendakil the First who established the office of steward. Arandir, king's servant. But he was chosen by the king as a man of high trust and wisdom, usually advanced in years since he was not permitted to go to war or to leave the realm. He was never a member of the royal house. Author's note. End of note. This delivery was from then onwards always performed, though the custom of visiting the hallow of Amon Anwar with his heir was maintained by nearly all the kings of Gondor. When the days of the kings came to an end, and Gondor was ruled by the stewards descended from Húrin, the steward of King Minardil, it was held that all the rights and duties of the kings were theirs until the great king returns. But in the matter of the tradition of Isildur, they alone were the judges, since it was known only to them. They judged that by the words, an heir of Elendil, Isildur had meant one of the royal line descended from Elendil, who had inherited the throne, but that he did not foresee the rule of the stewards. If then Mardil had exercised the authority of the king in his absence, the heirs of Mardil who had inherited the stewardship had the same right and duty until a king returned. Each steward, therefore, had the right to visit the Hallow when he would, and to admit to it those who came with him, as he thought fit. Note 54. Mardil was the first of the ruling stewards of Gondor. He was the steward to Eärnar, the last king, who disappeared in Minas Morgul in the year 2050. It was believed in Gondor that the faithless enemy had trapped the king, and that he had died in torment in Minas Morgul. But since there were no witnesses of his death, Mardil the good steward ruled Gondor in his name for many years. The Lord of the Rings, Appendix A, 1-4. End of note. As for the words, while the kingdom endures, they said that Gondor remained a kingdom, ruled by a vice-regent, and that the words must therefore be held to mean as long as the state of Gondor endures. Nonetheless, the stewards, partly from awe and partly from the cares of the kingdom, went very seldom to the Hallow on the Hill of Anwar, except when they took their heir to the hilltop, according to the custom of the kings. Sometimes it remained for several years unvisited, and as Isildur had prayed, it was in the keeping of the Valar. For though the woods might grow tangled and be avoided by men because of the silence, so that the upward path was lost, still, when the way was reopened, the Hallow was found unweathered and unprofaned, ever green and at peace under the sky, until the kingdom of Gondor was changed. For it came to pass that Kirion, the 12th of the ruling stewards, was faced by a new and great danger. Invaders threatened the conquest of all the lands of Gondor north of the White Mountains, and if that were to happen, the downfall and destruction of the whole kingdom must soon follow. As is known in the histories, this peril was averted only by the aid of the Rohirrim, and to them Kirion with great wisdom granted all the northern lands, save Anorion, to be under their own rule and king, though in perpetual alliance with Gondor. There were no longer sufficient men in the realm to people the northward region, nor even to maintain in force the line of forts along the Anduin that had guarded its eastward boundary. Kirion gave long thought to this matter before he granted Colinarthon to the horsemen of the north, and he judged that its cession must change wholly the tradition of Isildur with regard to the Hallow of Amon Anwar. To that place he brought the lord of the Rohirrim, and there by the mound of Elendil he with the greatest solemnity took the oath of Eärl, and was answered by the oath of Kirion, confirming forever the alliance of the kingdoms of the Rohirrim and of Gondor. But when this was done, and Eärl had returned to the north to bring back all his people to their new dwelling, Kirion removed the tomb of Elendil, for he judged that the tradition of Isildur was now made void. The Hallow was no longer at the midpoint of the kingdom of the south, but on the borders of another realm. And moreover, the words, while the kingdom endures, referred to the kingdom as it was when Isildur spoke, after surveying its bounds and defining them. It was true that other parts of the kingdom had been lost since that day. Minas Ithil was in the hands of the Nazgûl, and Ithilien was desolate. But Gondor had not relinquished its claim to them. Colinarthon it had resigned forever under oath. The casket, therefore, that Isildur had set within the mound Kirion removed to the Hallows of Minas Tirith, but the green mound remained as the memorial of a memorial. Nonetheless, even when it had become the site of a great beacon, the Hill of Anwar was still a place of reverence to Gondor and to the Rohirrim, who named it in their own tongue Halafirion, the Holy Mount. 3. The Quest of Erebor. Editor.
This story depends for its full understanding on the narrative given in Appendix A, 3, Durin's Folk, to the Lord of the Rings, of which this is an outline. The dwarves Thror and his son Thrain, together with Thrain's son Thorin, afterwards called Oakenshield, escaped from the lonely mountain, Erebor, by a secret door when the dragon Smaug descended upon it. Thror returned to Moria after giving to Thrain the last of the seven rings of the dwarves and was killed there by the orc Azog, who branded his name on Thror's brow. It was this that led to the War of the Dwarves and the Orcs, which ended in the great battle of Azanulbizar, Nanduhirion, before the east gate of Moria in the year 2799. Afterwards, Thrain and Thorin Oakenshield dwelt in the arid Luin, but in the year 2841, Thrain set out from there to return to the Lonely Mountain. While wandering in the lands east of Anduin, he was captured and imprisoned in Dol Guldur, where the ring was taken from him. In 2850, Gandalf entered Dol Guldur and discovered that its master was indeed Sauron, and there he came upon Thrain before he died. There is more than one version of the quest of Erebor, as is explained in an appendix following the text, where also substantial extracts from an earlier version are given. I have not found any writing preceding the opening words of the present text, "He would say no more that day." The he of the opening sentence is Gandalf. We are Frodo, Peregrine, Meriadoc, and Gimli. And I is Frodo, the recorder of the conversation. The scene is a house in Minas Tirith, after the coronation of King Elisar. See page 329. Author. He would say no more that day. But later we brought the matter up again, and he told us the whole strange story. How he came to arrange the journey to Erebor, why he thought of Bilbo, and how he persuaded the proud Thorin Oakenshield to take him into his company. I cannot remember all the tale now, but we gathered that to begin with, Gandalf was thinking only of the defense of the West against the Shadow. I was very troubled at that time, he said, for Saruman was hindering all my plans. I knew that Sauron had arisen again and would soon declare himself. And I knew that he was preparing for a great war. How would he begin? Would he try first to reoccupy Mordor, or would he first attack the chief strongholds of his enemies? I thought then, and I am sure now, that to attack Lorien and Rivendell as soon as he was strong enough was his original plan. It would have been a much better plan for him, and much worse for us. You may think that Rivendell was out of his reach, but I did not think so. The state of things in the north was very bad. The kingdom under the mountain and the strong men of Dale were no more. To resist any force that Sauron might send to regain the northern passes in the mountains and the old lands of Angmar, there were only the dwarves of the Iron Hills, and behind them lay a desolation and a dragon. The dragon Sauron might use with terrible effect. Often I said to myself, I must find some means of dealing with Smaug. But a direct stroke against Dol Guldur is needed still more. We must disturb Sauron's plans. I must make the council see that. Those were my dark thoughts as I jogged along the road. I was tired, and I was going to the Shire for a short rest after being away from it for more than 20 years. I thought that if I put them out of my mind for a while, I might perhaps find some way of dealing with these troubles. And so I did, indeed, though I was not allowed to put them out of my mind. For just as I was nearing Bree, I was overtaken by Thorin Oakenshield, who lived then in exile beyond the northwestern borders of the Shire. Note 1. The meeting of Gandalf with Thorin is related also in Appendix A, 3, to The Lord of the Rings, and there the date is given, 15 March 2941. There is the slight difference between the two accounts that in Appendix A, the meeting took place in the inn at Bree and not on the road. Gandalf had last visited the Shire 20 years before, thus in 2921, when Bilbo was 31. Gandalf says later that he had not quite come of age at 33 when he last saw him. End of note. To my surprise, he spoke to me, and it was at that moment that the tide began to turn. He was troubled, too, so troubled that he actually asked for my advice.
So I went with him to his halls in the Blue Mountains, and I listened to his long tale. I soon understood that his heart was hot with brooding on his wrongs, and the loss of the treasure of his forefathers, and burdened, too, with the duty of revenge upon Smaug that he had inherited. Dwarves take such duties very seriously. I promised to help him if I could. I was as eager as he was to see the end of Smaug, but Thorin was all for plans of battle and war, as if he were really King Thorin II, and I could see no hope in that. So I left him, and went off to the Shire, and picked up the threads of news. It was a strange business. I did no more than follow the lead of chance, and made many mistakes on the way. Somehow I had been attracted by Bilbo long before, as a child and a young hobbit. He had not quite come of age when I had last seen him. He had stayed in my mind ever since, with his eagerness and his bright eyes, and his love of tales, and his questions about the wide world outside the Shire. As soon as I entered the Shire, I heard news of him. He was getting talked about, it seemed. Both his parents had died early for Shire folk, at about 80, and he had never married. He was already growing a bit queer, they said, and went off for days by himself. He could be seen talking to strangers, even dwarves. Even dwarves! Suddenly in my mind these three things came together. The great dragon with his lust and his keen hearing and scent. The sturdy, heavy-booted dwarves with their old, burning grudge. And the quick, soft-footed hobbit, sick at heart, I guessed, for a sight of the wide world. I laughed at myself. But I went off at once to have a look at Bilbo, to see what 20 years had done to him, and whether he was as promising as gossip seemed to make out. But he was not at home. They shook their heads in Hobbiton when I asked after him. "Off again?" said one hobbit. It was Holman, the gardener, I believe. Note 2. Holman, the gardener. Holman Greenhand, to whom Hamfast Gamgee, Sam's father, the gaffer, was apprenticed. The Fellowship of the Ring, 1-1, and Appendix C. End of note. "Off again? He'll go right off one of these days if he isn't careful. Why, I asked him where he was going and when he would be back. And I don't know, he says. And then he looks at me queerly. 'It depends if I meet any, Holman,' he says. 'It's the Elves' New Year tomorrow.'" Note 3. The Elvish solar year, Loa, began with a day called Yestare, which was the day before the first day of Tuile, spring. And in the calendar of Imladris, Yestare corresponded more or less with Shire April 6, The Lord of the Rings, Appendix D. End of note. "A pity, and him so kind a body. You wouldn't find a better from the downs to the river." Better and better, I thought. I think I shall risk it. Time was getting short. I had to be with the White Council in August at the latest, or Saruman would have his way, and nothing would be done. And quite apart from greater matters, that might prove fatal to the quest. The power in Dol Guldur would not leave any attempt on Erebor unhindered, unless he had something else to deal with. So I rode off back to Thorin in haste, to tackle the difficult task of persuading him to put aside his lofty designs and go secretly and take Bilbo with him. Without seeing Bilbo first, it was a mistake, and nearly proved disastrous. For Bilbo had changed, of course. At least, he was getting rather greedy and fat, and his old desires had dwindled down to a sort of private dream. Nothing could have been more dismaying than to find it actually in danger of coming true. He was altogether bewildered, and made a complete fool of himself. Thorin would have left in a rage, but for another strange chance, which I will mention in a moment. But you know how things went, at any rate, as Bilbo saw them. The story would sound rather different if I had written it. For one thing, he did not realize at all how fatuous the dwarves thought him, nor how angry they were with me. Thorin was much more indignant and contemptuous than he perceived. He was indeed contemptuous from the beginning, and thought then that I had planned the whole affair simply so as to make a mock of him. It was only the map and the key that saved the situation. But I had not thought of them for years. It was not until I got to the Shire and had time to reflect on Thorin's tale that I suddenly remembered the strange chance that had put them in my hands. And it began now to look less like chance. I remembered a dangerous journey of mine 91 years before, when I had entered Dol Guldur in disguise, and had found there an unhappy dwarf dying in the pits. I had no idea who he was. He had a map that had belonged to Durin's folk in Moria, and a key that seemed to go with it, though he was too far gone to explain it. And he said that he had possessed a great ring. Nearly all his ravings were of that. The last of the seven, he said, over and over again. But all these things he might have come by in many ways. He might have been a messenger caught as he fled, or even a thief trapped by a greater thief. But he gave the map and the key to me. "For my son," he said. And then he died. And soon after, I escaped myself. I stowed the things away, and by some warning of my heart, I kept them always with me, safe, but soon almost forgotten. I had other business in Dol Guldur, more important and perilous than all the treasure of Erebor. Now I remembered it all again, and it seemed clear that I had heard the last words of Thrain the Second, though he did not name himself or his son. And Thorin, of course, did not know what had become of his father, nor did he ever mention the last of the Seven Rings. Note 4. Thrain the Second. Thrain the First, Thorin's distant ancestor, escaped from Moria in the year 1981 and became the first king under the mountain. The Lord of the Rings, Appendix A, 3. End of note. I had the plan and the key of the secret entrance to Erebor, by which Thror and Thrain had escaped, according to Thorin's tale. And I had kept them, though without any design of my own, until the moment when they would prove most useful. Fortunately, I did not make any mistake in my use of them. I kept them up my sleeve, as you say in the Shire, until things looked quite hopeless. As soon as Thorin saw them, he really made up his mind to follow my plan, as far as a secret expedition went, at any rate. Whatever he thought of Bilbo, he would have set out himself. The existence of a secret door, only discoverable by dwarves, made it seem at least possible to find out something of the dragon's doings, perhaps even to recover some gold or some heirloom, to ease his heart's longings. But that was not enough for me. I knew in my heart that Bilbo must go with him, or the whole quest would be a failure, or, as I should say now, the far more important events by the way would not come to pass. So I had still to persuade Thorin to take him. There were many difficulties on the road afterwards, but for me this was the most difficult part of the whole affair. Though I argued with him far into the night after Bilbo had retired, it was not finally settled until early the next morning. Thorin was contemptuous and suspicious. "He is soft," he snorted, "soft as the mud of his shire, and silly. His mother died too soon. You are playing some crooked game of your own, Master Gandalf. I am sure that you have other purposes than helping me." "You are quite right," I said. "If I had no other purposes, I should not be helping you at all. Great as your affairs may seem to you, they are only a small strand in the great web. I am concerned with many strands. But that should make my advice more weighty, not less." I spoke at last with great heat. "Listen to me, Thorin Oakenshield," I said. "If this hobbit goes with you, you will succeed. If not, you will fail. A foresight is on me, and I am warning you." "I know your fame," Thorin answered. "I hope it is merited. But this foolish business of your hobbit makes me wonder whether it is foresight that is on you, and you are not crazed rather than foreseeing. So many cares may have disordered your wits." "They have certainly been enough to do so," I said, "and among them I find most exasperating a proud dwarf who seeks advice from me, without claim on me that I know of, and then rewards me with insolence. Go your own ways, Thorin Oakenshield, if you will. But if you flout my advice, you will walk to disaster, and you will get neither counsel nor aid from me again until the shadow falls on you. And curb your pride and your greed, or you will fall at the end of whatever path you take, though your hands be full of gold." He blenched a little at that, but his eyes smoldered. "Do not threaten me," he said. "I will use my own judgment in this matter, as in all that concerns me." "Do so, then," I said. "I can say no more, unless it is this. I do not give my love or trust lightly, Thorin,
but I am fond of this hobbit, and wish him well. Treat him well, and you shall have my friendship to the end of your days." I said that without hope of persuading him, but I could have said nothing better. Dwarves understand devotion to friends and gratitude to those who help them. "Very well," Thorin said at last, after a silence. "He shall set out with my company, if he dares, which I doubt. But if you insist on burdening me with him, you must come too and look after your darling." "Good," I answered. "I will come, and stay with you as long as I can, at least until you have discovered his worth." It proved well in the end, but at the time I was troubled, for I had the urgent matter of the White Council on my hands. So it was that the quest of Erebor set out. I do not suppose that when it started, Thorin had any real hope of destroying Smaug. There was no hope. Yet it happened. But alas, Thorin did not live to enjoy his triumph or his treasure. Pride and greed overcame him, in spite of my warning. "But surely," I said, "he might have fallen in battle anyway. There would have been an attack of orcs, however generous Thorin had been with his treasure." "That is true," said Gandalf. "Poor Thorin. He was a great dwarf of a great house, whatever his faults. And though he fell at the end of the journey, it was largely due to him that the kingdom under the mountain was restored, as I desired. But Dain Ironfoot was a worthy successor. And now we hear that he fell fighting before Erebor again, even while we fought here. I should call it a heavy loss, if it was not a wonder, rather, that in his great age he could still wield his axe as mightily as they say he did, standing over the body of King Brond before the gate of Erebor until the darkness fell." Note 5. Dain the Second, Ironfoot, was born in the year 2767. At the Battle of Azanulbizar, Nanduhirion, in 2799, he slew before the east gate of Moria the great orc Azog, and so avenged Thror, Thorin's grandfather. He died in the Battle of Dale in 3019. The Lord of the Rings, Appendices A, 3, and B. Frodo learnt from Gloan at Rivendell that Dain was still king under the mountain and was now old, having passed his 250th year, venerable and fabulously rich. The Fellowship of the Ring, 2-1. End of note. It might all have gone very differently indeed. The main attack was diverted southwards, it is true. And yet even so, with his far-stretched right hand, Sauron could have done terrible harm in the north, while we defended Gondor, if King Brond and King Dain had not stood in his path. When you think of the great battle of Pelennor, do not forget the battle of Dale. Think of what might have been. Dragonfire and savage swords in Eriador. There might be no queen in Gondor. We might now only hope to return from the victory here to ruin and ash. But that has been averted, because I met Thorin Oakenshield one evening on the edge of spring not far from Bree. A chance meeting, as we say in Middle-earth. Appendix. Note on the texts of The Quest of Erebor. Editor. The textual situation in this piece is complex and hard to unravel. The earliest version is a complete but rough and much amended manuscript, which I will here call A. It bears the title, The History of Gandalf's Dealings with Thrain and Thorin Oakenshield. From this, a typescript, B, was made, with a great deal of further alteration, though mostly of a very minor kind. This is entitled, The Quest of Erebor, and also, Gandalf's account of how he came to arrange the expedition to Erebor and send Bilbo with the dwarves. Some extensive extracts from the typescript text are given below. In addition to A and B, the earlier version, there is another manuscript, C, untitled, which tells the story in a more economical and tightly constructed form, omitting a good deal from the first version and introducing some new elements, but also, particularly in the latter part, largely retaining the original writing. It seems to me to be quite certain that C is later than B, and C is the version that has been given above, although some writing has apparently been lost from the beginning, setting the scene in Minas Tirith for Gandalf's recollections.
The opening paragraphs of B, given below, are almost identical with a passage in Appendix A. 3. Durin's folk to the Lord of the Rings, and obviously depend on the narrative concerning Thror and Thrain that precedes them in Appendix A. While the ending of the quest of Erebor is also found in almost exactly the same words in Appendix A, 3, here again in the mouth of Gandalf, speaking to Frodo and Gimli in Minas Tirith. In view of the letter cited in the introduction, page 11, it is clear that my father wrote The Quest of Erebor to stand as part of the narrative of Durin's folk in Appendix A. Extracts from the earlier version. The typescript B of the earlier version begins thus. Author. So Thorin Oakenshield became the heir of Durin, but an heir without hope. At the sack of Erebor, he had been too young to bear arms. But at Azanulbizar, he had fought in the van of the assault. And when Thrain was lost, he was 95, a great dwarf of proud bearing. He had no ring, and for that reason, maybe, he seemed content to remain in Eriador. There he labored long and gained such wealth as he could, and his people were increased by many of the wandering folk of Durin that heard of his dwelling and came to him. Now they had fair halls in the mountains and store of goods, and their days did not seem so hard, though in their songs they spoke ever of the lonely mountain far away, and the treasure and the bliss of the great hall in the light of the Arkenstone. The years lengthened. The embers in the heart of Thorin grew hot again as he brooded on the wrongs of his house and of the vengeance upon the dragon that was bequeathed to him. He thought of weapons and armies and alliances as his great hammer rang in the forge. But the armies were dispersed and the alliances broken and the axes of his people were few, and a great anger without hope burned him as he smote the red iron on the anvil. Gandalf had not yet played any part in the fortunes of Durin's house. He had not had many dealings with the dwarves, though he was a friend to those of good will, and liked well the exiles of Durin's folk who lived in the west. But on a time it chanced that he was passing through Eriador, going to the Shire, which he had not seen for some years, when he fell in with Thorin Oakenshield, and they talked together on the road, and rested for the night at Bree. In the morning, Thorin said to Gandalf, I have much on my mind, and they say you are wise and know more than most of what goes on in the world. Will you come home with me and hear me, and give me your counsel? To this Gandalf agreed, and when they came to Thorin's hall, he sat long with him, and heard all the tale of his wrongs. From this meeting there followed many deeds and events of great moment. Indeed, the finding of the One Ring, and its coming to the Shire, and the choosing of the Ring-Bearer. Many therefore have supposed that Gandalf foresaw all these things and chose his time for the meeting with Thorin. Yet we believe that it was not so, for in his tale of the War of the Ring, Frodo the Ring-Bearer left a record of Gandalf's words on this very point. This is what he wrote. Editor, in place of the words, this is what he wrote, A, the earliest manuscript, has, that passage was omitted from the tale since it seemed long, but most of it we now set out here. Author. After the crowning, we stayed in a fair house in Minas Tirith with Gandalf, and he was very merry. And though we asked him questions about all that came into our minds, his patience seemed as endless as his knowledge. I cannot now recall most of the things that he told us. Often we did not understand them. But I remember this conversation very clearly. Gimli was there with us, and he said to Peregrine, There is a thing I must do one of these days. I must visit that shire of yours. Footnote. Gimli must at least have passed through the Shire on journeys from his original home in the Blue Mountains. See page 336. End of footnote.
Not to see more hobbits. I doubt if I could learn anything about them that I do not know already. But no dwarf of the House of Durin could fail to look with wonder on that land. Did not the recovery of the kingship under the mountain and the fall of Smaug begin there? Not to mention the end of Barad-dûr, though both were strangely woven together. Strangely, very strangely, he said, and paused. Then looking hard at Gandalf, he went on. But who wove the web? I do not think I have ever considered that before. Did you plan all this, then, Gandalf? If not, why did you lead Thorin Oakenshield to such an unlikely door? To find the ring and bring it far away into the west for hiding, and then to choose the ring-bearer? And to restore the Mountain Kingdom as a mere deed by the way? Was not that your design?
Gandalf did not answer at once. He stood up and looked out of the window, west, seawards, and the sun was then setting, and a glow was in his face. He stood so a long while silent, but at last he turned to Gimli and said, I do not know the answer, for I have changed since those days, and I am no longer trammeled by the burden of Middle-earth as I was then. In those days I should have answered you with words like those I used to Frodo only last year in the spring. Only last year. But such measures are meaningless. In that far distant time I said to a small and frightened hobbit, Bilbo was meant to find the ring, and not by its maker, and you therefore were meant to bear it. And I might have added, and I was meant to guide you both to those points. To do that I used in my waking mind only such means as were allowed to me, doing what lay to my hand according to such reasons as I had. But what I knew in my heart, or knew before I stepped on these gray shores, that is another matter. Aloran I was in the west that is forgotten, and only to those who are there shall I speak more openly. Editor, A has here, and only to those who are there, or who may perhaps return thither with me, shall I speak more openly. Author, then I said, I understand you a little better now, Gandalf, than I did before, though I suppose that, whether meant or not, Bilbo might have refused to leave home, and so might I. You could not compel us. You were not even allowed to try. But I am still curious to know why you did what you did, as you were then an old gray man, as you seemed. Editor. Gandalf then explained to them his doubts at that time concerning Sauron's first move, and his fears for Lórien and Rivendell. Compare page 322. In this version, after saying that a direct stroke against Sauron was even more urgent than the question of Smaug, he went on. Author. That is why, to jump forward, I went off as soon as the expedition against Smaug was well started, and persuaded the council to attack Dol Guldur first, before he attacked Lórien. We did, and Sauron fled, but he was always ahead of us in his plans. I must confess that I thought he really had retreated again, and that we might have another spell of watchful peace. But it did not last long. Sauron decided to take the next step. He returned at once to Mordor, and in 10 years he declared himself. Then everything grew dark. And yet that was not his original plan, and it was in the end a mistake. Resistance still had somewhere where it could take counsel free from the shadow. How could the ring-bearer have escaped if there had been no Lórien or Rivendell? And those places might have fallen, I think, if Sauron had thrown all his power against them first, and not spent more than half of it in the assault on Gondor. Well, there you have it. That was my chief reason. But it is one thing to see what needs doing, and quite another to find the means. I was beginning to be seriously troubled about the situation in the north when I met Thorin Oakenshield one day, in the middle of March 2941, I think. I heard all his tale, and I thought, well, here is an enemy of Smaug, at any rate, and one worthy of help. I must do what I can. I should have thought of dwarves before. And then there was the Shire folk. I began to have a warm place in my heart for them in the long winter, which none of you can remember. Footnote. There is an account of the long winter of 2758-59, as it affected Rohan, in Appendix A-2 to The Lord of the Rings. And the entry in the Tale of Years mentions that Gandalf came to the aid of the Shire folk. End of footnote. They were very hard put to it then, one of the worst pinches they have been in, dying of cold and starving in the dreadful dearth that followed. But that was the time to see their courage and their pity one for another. It was by their pity as much as by their tough, uncomplaining courage that they survived. I wanted them still to survive. But I saw that the Westlands were in for another very bad time again, sooner or later, though of quite a different sort. Pitiless war. To come through that, I thought they would need something more than they now had. It is not easy to say what. Well, they would want to know a bit more, understand a bit clearer what it was all about, and where they stood. They had begun to forget. Forget their own beginnings and legends. forget what little they had known about the greatness of the world. It was not yet gone, but it was getting buried, the memory of the high and the perilous. But you cannot teach that sort of thing to a whole people quickly. There was not time. And anyway, you must begin at some point, with some one person. I dare say he was chosen, and I was only chosen to choose him. But I picked out Bilbo.
Now that is just what I want to know, said Peregrine. Why did you do that?
How would you select any one hobbit for such a purpose? Said Gandalf. I had not time to sort them all out, but I knew the Shire very well by that time, although when I met Thorin I had been away for more than 20 years on less pleasant business. So naturally, thinking over the hobbits that I knew, I said to myself, I want a dash of the Took, but not too much, Master Peregrine. And I want a good foundation of the stolider sort, a Baggins, perhaps. That pointed at once to Bilbo, and I had known him once very well, almost up to his coming of age, better than he knew me. I liked him then, and now I found that he was unattached, to jump on again, for of course I did not know all this until I went back to the Shire. I learned that he had never married. I thought that odd, though I guessed why it was, and the reason that I guessed was not the one that most of the hobbits gave me, that he had early been left very well off, and his own master. No, I guessed that he wanted to remain unattached, for some reason deep down which he did not understand himself, or would not acknowledge, for it alarmed him. He wanted all the same to be free to go when the chance came, or he had made up his courage. I remembered how he used to pester me with questions when he was a youngster about the hobbits that had occasionally gone off, as they said in the Shire. There were at least two of his uncles on the Took side that had done so.